stopping the deadly toll of the opiate crisis in treatment and in the courts. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross, and thanks for listening. Just ahead, the latest in efforts to treat the opioid epidemic here in Florida, and your calls and tweets. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Then later, a new study from the Union of Concerned Scientists. It looks at the implications of rising seas on our Florida coastal real estate. We'll have the latest information. Plus, they're taking dinner theater to a whole new level through the food of love. We'll tell you about that, too. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first this morning, a huge settlement announced this week as the makers of OxyContin reached a $270 million settlement with the state of Oklahoma for the painkiller's role in the nation's opioid crisis. At the same time, new research just out from the Centers for Disease Control shows troubling trends in how the opioid overdose epidemic is impacting certain groups in America, including Black and Latino Americans. Also, there's interesting data to look at how different age groups are being affected. Now, here in Florida, as we know, the opiate crisis has taken a terrible toll, so much so that Jacksonville is taking on the pharmaceutical companies with legal action of its own. There's also a new pilot program in the city aimed at helping people in the throes of addiction. We have an update about all of this right now as we welcome Dr. Christine Caulfield. She's CEO of LSF Health Systems and joins us here in studio. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And joining us by phone, Jacksonville City Councilman Bill Gulliford. Councilman, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And the number to join us is 549-2937. That's 549-2937. As we discuss all the news that's come out just in the last couple of days around the opiate crisis and how that affects us here in Florida, give us a call at 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax, and weigh in on Facebook, our Facebook page as well. In a moment, we'll hear from Dr. Caulfield about the new local study and or rather the CDC study and the implications here in Florida. But first, Councilman Gulliford, could I get your reaction, first off, to this $270 million settlement with the state of Oklahoma as they took the opioid makers to court? That's a huge and landmark settlement, and it's by far from the only legal action states and municipalities have undertaken to try to hold Big Pharma accountable for this crisis. Your reaction to that, and also, can you bring us up to date on what the city of Jacksonville is doing around this in the legal realm as well?
Well, my reaction is I wish it was Jacksonville that was settling instead of Oklahoma for that amount of money.
Sure.
But realizing that that's not the case, we have a suit pending, obviously, as you mentioned. We want to see that suit tried in state court. It's been moved to a federal, there's some type of potential federal class action, and I'm not schooled enough in that part of the law to talk intelligently, but what our attorneys are trying to do is get it returned to state court. They feel like they've got a pretty good chance. We will continue to pursue the action, obviously, because I feel like that they owe us for the heavy financial burden that this has placed on the citizens of Jacksonville. So we will continue to go after that.
And what would you estimate that financial burden to be in Duval County when it comes to the toll in terms of taking people who've overdosed for treatment, the cost of treatment therapy, JFRD runs? There's so much that goes into this. What would be a ballpark number that you think this is costing this city?
I have absolutely no idea because the ramifications are great. I didn't see. We did at the direction of the attorney or the legal firm in New York. They did gather information, try and come up with that number, and I don't remember what the total number was, but it's significant, as you would imagine. But I think you also have to look at the part of it that's so difficult to put a dollar amount on. I mean, obviously we can come up with numbers for the cost of the paramedic response and those kinds of things. You mentioned treatment. I don't know that treatment was necessarily part of that equation, but you know, look at the financial repercussions to businesses with employees that are addicted, and the other things that happen relative to how this thing just disrupts life, families, businesses, you name it. So we have that number, and I'm just not privy to it right now.
Okay.
So I'm sorry.
Sure, but certainly it's a big number, and it's
a huge number. It's,
yeah.
I know we're talking millions of dollars. That much I know. I mean, you can just look at the number of overdose calls that we've responded to, fire and rescue have responded to over the last 4 years or so, and it's very significant. And remember something else: probably over 60% of those responses we're transporting people that are either underinsured or not insured, and guess who ends up paying for that? So, you know, the cost runs deep and it's widespread.
It's 549-2937 to join us this morning. We'll go to your calls in a moment as landmark legal settlements are announced that the pharmaceutical companies have to pay to be held accountable for their role in the opiate crisis. Now, of course, Big Pharma started marketing OxyContin in the 1990s. And we want to now have everyone take a listen to a commercial that aired circa 1998. This is from Purdue Pharma, and it was marketing OxyContin. Take a listen.
There's no question that our best, strongest pain medicines are the opioids, but these are the same drugs that have a reputation for causing addiction and other terrible things. Now, in fact, the rate of addiction amongst pain patients who are treated by doctors is much less than 1%. They don't wear out, they go on working, they do not have serious medical side effects, and so these drugs, which I repeat are our best, strongest pain medications, should be used much more than they are for patients in pain.
Addiction rates of much less than 1%. Wow. Okay, let's get Dr. Caulfield into the discussion now. Dr. Christine Caulfield, she's CEO of LSF Health System here in Jacksonville, a leading center in the treatment of opioid addiction here on the First Coast. Dr. Caulfield, in the fullness of time, that ad and the ads that aired like it are truly horrifying to listen to, aren't they?
They really are. And I think that people want to see Big Pharma held accountable. That was totally untrue. We see people at LSF Health Systems and within our provider network that become addicted to OxyContin within 2 weeks of taking the prescription. So false, false, false. And the damage, as Commissioner Gulliford mentioned, just has tentacles everywhere.
Yeah. Now, in the late 90s, we saw what's now seen as the first wave of the opioid epidemic when this drug first became aggressively marketed. Officials started cracking down on the drugs in the new millennium. They got harder to get. Many addicts turned to heroin. Now we're in what you call the third wave of this crisis. What is the third wave?
The third wave is fentanyl, the deadly, deadly synthetic opioid that is manufactured in China, packaged in Mexico, and coming into the United States. 50 times more potent than heroin. And it is being laced not only in heroin, but now we're discovering it in cocaine, methamphetamines, even marijuana.
And what do the new figures just out this week from the Centers for Disease Control reveal about how this epidemic is taking its toll in different population groups here in Florida and nationally?
Yes. Jacksonville, unfortunately, is top of the list in Florida for opioid overdose deaths. And we are very, very concerned. I want to say kudos to Commissioner Gulliford and the rest of the city council for taking a leadership stance in this arena, funding programs that are fighting this scourge, but so much more is needed.
Councilman Gulliford, as Dr. Caulfield said, Jacksonville is at the top of a list we don't want to be on. We're apparently, according to the CDC, leading the state in opioid deaths. As you said, the Jacksonville City Council is going after the pharmaceutical companies legally. You've also funded a pilot program in Duval to help people seeking to recover from their addictions. I believe it was $1.2 million was allocated. Is that right?
I think it was $1.4 million.
$1.4 million. And so how do you see that program, at least taking a bite out of this huge public health issue for North Florida?
Well, we started the program with one goal in mind, and that was to save lives. We know that there's much more beyond that to do, but doggone it, that was a first step. The program's been running at St. Vincent's Emergency Room for about 16 months now. We last count that I saw, we had 288 people enrolled in it. Up until last October, we could say we were free of anyone dying. Unfortunately, we've had a couple people that passed away, but we still are looking at significant numbers, recovery numbers, and prevention of people passing away. That program has been expanded into the St. Vincent's Emergency Room on the south side. We just opened up in Memorial Hospital. I don't know if we're into Park West on the west side yet or not, but that was imminent that we were going in there. You have to recognize something we found out that didn't really anticipate was, you know, it's real hard to get non-employees into an emergency room, both because of federal regulations, some of these larger hospital groups, et cetera. So we've kind of been retarded in that respect in getting in as quickly as we wanted to. We feel good about what we've done. The state working group that I'm a member of has recognized that we are doing some things that no one else in the state is doing and having good results. So we want to see that expand. The goal is 7 emergency rooms in this budget year. I'd like to see in every single emergency room, other cities and states. I know Dr. Gilberstadt, who's the head of the emergency department at St. Vincent's, has been getting a lot of contact, not only from around the state, but around the country as to what we're doing. And so I feel real good about that. And let me get a plug in before we go any farther. We just passed legislation to create a trust fund that will be administered by basically by professionals. We're going to seek contributions from outside. We've been asked before if people could donate to fight this thing, and so we have set that trust fund up and would welcome any kind of contributions, both private grants or whatever. So I wanted to make the listeners aware of that.
Thanks for sharing that. Another thing, Dr. Caulfield, that has been brought up a lot is that Narcan should be made more widely available, not just for medical professionals such as yourself, but I've heard people that are really working on the front lines of this epidemic say over and over again that everybody in America should have a container of Narcan in their medicine cabinet, that they should even make them available in public places, because that is the substance that can stop an overdose from happening. And it's just desperately needed now for so many people.
It really is. It's life-saving, literally life-saving. And the general public should be aware that they can indeed obtain Narcan at pharmacies.
And without a prescription.
Without a prescription, and freely distributed, so that if you have a loved one, a neighbor, someone that you're concerned about, you want to have that available so that you in turn can be able to save a life.
You can administer it, and if it turns out the person isn't in the throes of an overdose, it won't hurt the person.
That's correct.
Even if they get it and don't need it.
That is absolutely
right. Better to have it than not have it, right?
Indeed.
Okay, let's go to some calls now as we talk about the new CDC study on the toll of the opioid crisis and what's being done here in Jacksonville, which leads the state in opioid overdoses, according to the latest figures. 549-2937. Give us a call right now. Bill is in Mandarin. Hi, Bill. Good morning.
Hey, the reason I called, there was a very fine article on this subject in The New Yorker about 2 months ago. And it appears to be almost a criminal conspiracy by the Sackler family, who was the owner of this product and the pharma company Purdue. I'm a little surprised also to learn that the feds had a chance to go with these fellows a couple years back and declined to do so. For what reason, I do not know. But I was concerned here that the concern I've got is, and maybe perhaps Mr. Goldford knows this, if Purdue files bankruptcy, which it can't take too many hits of $250 million, where does that leave the rest of us?
Yeah, thanks for that. And, you know, it's interesting, Bill, that you say that, because the Sackler family did make a fortune off OxyContin. Museums now are rejecting their donations, like the Guggenheim Museum in New York. Councilman Gulliford, the Guggenheim announced they will not accept any gifts from this family because of their ties to the opioid crisis. So wanted to point that out. But what about his other point? Your thoughts?
Well, I understand, and that was secondhand information, that their revenue from OxyContin was $17 billion. So I'm sure a fair amount of that has been spent. Certainly, the types of hits would be of great concern, and I've certainly been aware of the fact that they could file bankruptcy, and then it would be a matter of what assets are available for all the claimants, and we might not get a whole lot. But, you know, we didn't want to sit around and wait for some kind of action by the state or whatever. I think as much as anything else, we wanted to make a statement and point fingers at who we think are really to blame for this thing. And the other problem I've got is you can't stereotype the addict in this situation. I had a young lady in my office yesterday who lost her husband. These were mainstream people. He got addicted from a prescription and went through absolute hell from that point on, and then finally died of an overdose. And she was devastated, obviously. But, you know, we can't look at these folks and say, well, they're just addicts that are out for recreational drugs. These are mainstream folks that have become addicted, not willingly, but because of the irresponsibility of both pharmaceutical companies and doctors. There's some doctors that certainly assume some of that blame too. So I would hope that we look at it as it is, and that's part of the thing that we need to look at, is it's widespread across all socioeconomic lines in our society.
Dr. Caulfield.
Absolutely. It's typically been coined the white male epidemic.
Yeah, and the CDC finding more men than women affected.
Yes, indeed.
But increasingly more people of color affected too.
That's right. There's a huge rise in the African American population as well as Hispanics that are becoming addicted and overdosing. Also, a very disturbing trend that the CDC pointed out was the fastest growing segment are young adults age 15 to 25. So we have a real problem going on in this country, and it doesn't seem to be stopping.
549-2937, lots of calls as we talk about the opioid crisis. Dixie is in Orange Park. Dixie, hello. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question. Are there statistics on what percentage of overdoses are prescription drugs versus illegal drugs?
Sure, whether they got it from a doctor or street fentanyl. Thanks for that question, Dixie. Dr. Caulfield, what about that?
Yes, a lot of our treatment facilities in our LSF health systems network are keeping that data. In other words, did the individual become addicted through a prescription and had no prior history of drug use versus those that perhaps had a heavy history prior to becoming addicted? So there's all sorts of data points that are being collected. And what we're finding, that's why it's called the third wave right now, is that the substances that people are taking, the fentanyl is the deadly ingredient, and that is synthetic.
Chuck at the Beaches is on the line. Hi, Chuck. You've called before about your son. I know you lost your son to this crisis, and I'm so sorry about that. Good morning to you,
Thank
Chuck.
You.
Go ahead.
Thanks. Yeah, I lost my son in 2016. We went through the whole process. So figure in 2016, he was 27. We went through the process. And he had some issues that he kind of self-medicated and, you know, psychological issues that help contribute to that. But I guess what I really want to say is, and you guys have been talking about this from a money perspective, and it's good, and you need the money to help treat people, and that's great. But what you haven't talked about is the consequences that the families are feeling from this. And when I look back on this, and I look back, and I'm a bit of a historian, and I've studied Doris Kearns Goodwin. When I look back on this under the Bush administration, the Obama administration, and currently under the Trump administration, and what, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that if you give someone an opioid prescription, it's going to be hell. So, I guess my question is, and you got some a medical person there, and you got a political person. How is it that the medical industry, and you guys are going to be held accountable for this, you couldn't figure this out in 2006 or 2007? And it's not getting better because we're in a hell of a mess. So fixing it's not going to be easy, but putting OxyContin in every kitchen cabinet in America, really? That was a smart move by the medical industry, and the politicians didn't do anything about it and were probably involved in it. And it's about money. That's what it was about. Thanks.
Thank you, Chuck. And you know, Dr. Caulfield, Councilman Gulliford, how about the fact, too, that in this country, pharmaceutical companies are allowed to advertise freely and aggressively whatever new drug they want to sell? There aren't a lot of restrictions placed on them, which is not the norm in a lot of other Western countries. What about that part of this, too? Because as Chuck pointed out, everybody got a bottle of this in their medicine cabinet because of the power of advertising. And false advertising basically was allowed to flourish.
Absolutely. And Chuck, you're so right. Follow the money. I don't know if you or the listeners have read the book Dreamland, but it really gives a historical account of how this horrible scourge in our country happened. And you're so right about following the money. This drug was passed by the ADA. It was marketed to physicians as non-addictive. The pharmaceutical company was successful in having pain be the fifth.
Classified as a fifth vital sign.
And hospitals were required to ask their patients how they were managing their pain. And they were penalized by their accrediting bodies if it were discovered that the hospital wasn't managing it correctly. So there's all sorts of systemic issues that contributed to this crisis. And I think your point on, follow the money.
Let's not forget the pill mills that existed in this state that were so active either, because that they were drawing lots of people from outside the state of Florida. It was so liberal in their dispensing of opioids that finally, when they got shut down, in some instances, you might have had a revolution because the people pushed back that were their patients. You're absolutely right about that. But you know what? A lot of people could be pointed to, even ourselves, because we've kind of become sissies since that became readily available, and nobody wanted any pain. I don't want pain either. But, you know, your point, Dr. Caulfield, is exactly right as far as how pain was managed in the past several years until this became a crisis. No doctor, no hospital was judged any harsher than if they didn't manage the pain of their patients. And we were a bit guilty in some of that, too.
Let me ask you, Dr. Caulfield, as a follow-up. The federal government released a report last week showing that more than 80% of the millions of people struggling with opioid addiction in the U.S. are not given easy access to the medications that can, increasingly it's seen as, prevent them from overdosing. The FDA has three meds that are approved to treat opioid use disorder: methadone, naltrexone, and buprenorphine. The access to buprenorphine has become a real bone of contention in this space. Other countries make it more widely available to help people ease off their addiction. Why is that such an issue in America? Why can't more patients in America get this medication?
You know, that's a great question. And there are a lot of restrictions on through the DEA for doctors to apply to be able to prescribe this medication. So that's one barrier that causes a slowdown and lack of access. Another, of course, is funding. We in Florida are 50th in the nation now for funding for behavioral health care, for substance abuse and mental health treatment. And we have to do a better job. And we have some champions in the legislature that are recognizing that and really coming to the rescue, if you will. But more funding is needed to be able to help individuals, particularly those that are indigent and uninsured.
Ellis is on the west side and has some thoughts. Hi, Ellis. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I was just telling the lady that morphine, everybody's always been in a sense scared of it. My own experience after cancer surgery, when I found out I could do what they wanted with a half, when I by accident got a half dose, and then I was waiting a day and a half to get my medication changed because, oh, that's morphine. We can't change it. And also the fact that morphine is the best pain medicine there is, but if you're on it very long, it becomes less effective.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Ellis. Thanks for sharing that. Let's take one more call on this. It's Rusty, also on the west side. Rusty, good morning to you. Go ahead.
Good morning. One of the things I wanted to add to Dr. Kofo's comments about the aggressive marketing was that these companies allowed the pharmaceutical companies send their own agents in, either through middlemen or distributors, to sell the OxyContin and other similar medications to the physicians and telling the physicians how to dose. In fact, telling them not only that it was not addictive, but they could titrate up the dosage unlimitedly because it was not addictive and that was not a harmful dosage, which was part of the reason why these folks got so addicted, because they were allowed to give huge dosages, and in fact, OxyContin was supposed to be dosed. Once they got to 80, they tried to double it to 160. When they did that, that was decided. That's when the government intervened and said it was too far, but still allowed them to do 80, which was nowadays a huge dose to give to anybody that most doctors would, revolt from.
Uh-huh. Sure. Rusty, thanks for that question. Dr. Caulfield, quickly, your answer on that one.
Yes. And another key point, Rusty, is that oxycodone and OxyContin are for acute pain, not for chronic pain. Yet it was marketed as not addictive and fine for individuals to take beyond the acute phase of their bone fracture or whatever other accident or injury that they sustained.
And as we wrap this up, Councilman Bill Gulliford, I so appreciate all of your insights about what the political space is doing around the opioid crisis. But I would remiss if I didn't ask you a question on another story while we've got you on the air. Last night, the city council voted to approve a plan from the mayor's office to have the city buy out Jacksonville Landing owner Tony Slayman, raise the property and put something new in that space, whether it's a public park or some combination of retail and park space and maybe apartments. We don't know. But I wanted to get your thoughts about that vote last night to send the Jacksonville Landing off into the history books. Your reaction to that, and you did vote for that.
Yes, I did. I guess I was part of the supermajority that voted for it. I mean, I don't think people are saying we're buying. Some people are saying we're buying the property or buying the building for $15 million. But in reality, Mr. Slayman had 37 years left on his contract. So you want to see it sit there as it is for another 37 years. I don't think anybody in the community wants to see that. So this gives us an opportunity to see the property develop. The question of raising the iconic landing or not was quite contentious with some folks in the community. But in reality, I think it really is the right thing to do. No one has proposed in any of the proposals, including for Mr. Slayman over the past however many years, no one's proposed retaining the landing. The building, the structure. So I think that everybody pretty much agreed that whatever goes there is going to be something that will be built new. And if you're going to do that, then the idea of proposing it to a developer where it is clear space makes sense, because you're going to take it down anyway, and this speeds the process to get something that everybody wants there. So I think that was probably the sentiment of the council last night when they voted.
What would you say to those who've become increasingly concerned about the raising of downtown buildings without a plan for what might go up in their place. I know City Hall does have some renderings and a plan of what they'd like to see go there. Still, though, as you drive around downtown, you see a lot of rubble and empty lots. And advocates of the whole movement known as adaptive reuse are asking city leaders to think about the reuse of buildings rather than just have them see the wrecking ball without a strong vision of what might go in the space. Are you concerned at all that an economic slowdown, if we see one in the next year or two, could lead to development not happening on some of these sites, not just the Landing, but other sites, and that we'll just be looking at empty lots for some time or half-built buildings like the Berkman Plaza?
You know what, Melissa? That would be the one. That would be the reference I would give. What has it been, 12 years we've been looking at the unfinished Berkman? Frankly, I would rather see a empty lot there than the unfinished Berkman. I think you can make a strong argument about the other structures as they continue to deteriorate and get vandalized and the like. I mean, we were looking at the Landing really in a serious decline. One thing you have to recognize, Mr. Slayman is quite a shopping center operator, and that was fundamentally a festival shopping center when it got started, and those are in decline. So the use of it, you know, just leaving it there for that sake, I think it puts pressure on us to have those vacant lots to go out and find the developers that want it. I know that there's already been some significant inquiries about the City Hall property and the County Courthouse property. So I'm going to be bullish and be optimistic that that will not linger very long as empty space and that we'll see development of it.
What would you like to see in the former Landing space?
Whatever the majority of the citizens think is the best idea for the use of that place, I don't have any great hang-up about what it would be. I'm really thinking that if we do development downtown, we're not going to drive a vibrant downtown unless we substantially increase the number of residential units there. And I think if it was a good bit of it was residential, I wouldn't have any problem with that. And same thing with the City Hall and County Courthouse property. You're not going to get the vibrant downtown until you get numbers downtown. And Charlotte certainly, for instance, can prove that. There are probably four or five times as many residents downtown in Charlotte as there are in Jacksonville.
Did you think at all about the argument that these other festival marketplaces around the country, there's one in Norfolk, Virginia, for example, they all went up in the 80s. They all started to struggle and fall out of fashion. But in the other cities where this phenomenon also occurred, they didn't tear the building down. They just redid it. They spruced it up. They changed it. They changed the concept of it. They didn't take down a functioning building. I think that's what is concerning the advocates of not seeing a building like that just flat out demolished. What about that? We'll be the only city that tears it down in total.
Well, that's not completely true. Mr. Cressman, he pointed out an experience he had with one, and I can't remember whether it was Dayton, Ohio, or whatever, built by Rouse, same kind of situation. He went there for some kind of convention, and ultimately they tore the thing down. I remember years ago when we bought a building for my business and we were going to redo it, and by the time we figured the cost of redoing it, we'd have been better off tearing it down, and that's what we did and built something new. It was substantially less. When you run the risk whenever you're repurposing a building of it not being suitable really for what you're trying to do, and you do get into cost overruns. I just don't think that I think its time is over. I think that you could make strong arguments about its current condition and whether you'd rather want to put that kind of money in. But, Melissa, no one in the last however many years, including Mr. Slayman, has advanced any proposal whatsoever that provided for renovating that building and reusing that building. So why not? I mean, I would think that if there was something out there, and remember, if somebody wants to come in the next 60 days, 90 days with some kind of proposal for reuse, that can still be considered. Mayor's office is certainly open to that.
Well, Councilman Gulliver, we really appreciate your thoughts both about that and the opioid crisis. So thanks for jumping on the line with us this morning. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
And
my
Dr.
Pleasure.
Christine Caulfield of LSF Health Systems, we so appreciate you being here as well. And where can people go to access treatment or get their loved ones the help they need?
Absolutely. We have an access to care line at LSF Health Systems that is manned 24/7 by our clinical team. And you can call that number and be connected to a clinician who then can find out where you live, what is the closest facility that has beds or whatever your needs are, and move that forward for you. So please don't forget about our access to care line. Give us a call. We are here to help.
And the number again?
The number is 1-877-229-9098. Again, 1-877-229-9098.
Write that number down if you or someone you care about needs access to care for opioid addiction. Dr. Christine Caulfield, always so good to have you on the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
And much more still ahead. Up next, a new study that looks at the implications of rising seas on our Florida coastal real estate. We're talking Ponte Vedra and the beaches. That's coming up, but right now our uninterrupted spring pledge drive is going on here at WJCT.
Across this country, news organizations have been trimming staff or closing up, but listeners like you keep public radio strong. I'm Steve Inskeep. When you step up to give now, you keep reporters in your region on the story. Public radio gives you serious, sustained examinations of our world. Help the journalism that you rely on stay strong. All you have to do is give.
So please call 353-9528 right now or visit us online at wjct.org.
Witness over three decades of jazz. Through 22 top five albums, five of which hit number one on the Billboard charts, The Rippingtons, featuring Russ Freeman, have continued to innovate. Jazz's Magazine has called their debut album the number one most influential contemporary jazz album of all time. Don't miss your chance to see the Rippingtons live at the WJCT Soundstage, March 28th. Tickets on sale now at floridatheater.com.
On the front page of today's Times Union.
At the top of the page, Florida lawmakers made...
Around the country, volunteers are reading local newspapers to people with vision loss or print disabilities. Did you know WJCT has this service? On a special radio we provide, you'll get the Florida Times Union every day. Learn more at wjct.org/radio reading. With help from sponsors like Florida Eye Specialists, Radio Reading gives voice to the printed word.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Well, chronic tidal flooding due to rising seas is threatening property all along Florida's coast. That's the key finding in a new landmark study from the Union of Concerned Scientists. In today's Going Green, we speak with Shauna Udvardi, a climate resilience analyst with the UCS. Take a listen. Shauna Udvardi, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me about the new study from the Union of Concerned Scientists about flooding in Florida in particular and what that means for property owners along our coasts.
We, over the summer of 2018, we released this new report called Underwater, Chronic Inundation, Rising Seas, and the Risk to Coastal Real Estate. And we wanted to really get at the what we think is flying under the radar, which is the value of properties that are at risk of this type of chronic tidal flooding. The tidal flooding that increasingly we're seeing at every high tide due to rising seas. And so what we found was nationwide, over 300,000 homes are at risk of this type of chronic inundation in 2045. And at the end of the century, that increases to about 1 trillion homes. And this means that there's a lot of coastal real estate at risk. For Florida, it's one of the states in the lower 48 that has the most homes at risk this century. We found that 64,000 homes in 2045 are at risk, and these are valued at $26 billion. In Jacksonville, the places that are most at risk of tidal flooding are Punta Vedra, Jacksonville Beaches, and Jacksonville East. And so, for example, in 2045, and Punta Vedra, there are about 902 homes are at risk. This is about 7% of the community. So with tidal flooding, and as we go into the future, it's likely that homes are going to be devalued and commercial properties may be devalued as we see more flooding at every high tide. So this may mean that there'll be a erosion of the tax base, and a tax base that's so needed for local services. The good news is, we looked at what we can do with lowering emissions and how many homes can be spared. So we used a low sea level rise scenario as a proxy or as an example of what it will look like if we keep to the goals of the Paris Agreement. And we found nationwide we can spare 85% of the homes this type of tidal flooding. And it's even higher in Florida. In Florida, under a low emission scenario at the end of the century, we could see 93% of the homes spared this type of chronic inundation due to rising seas. So this really underscores the urgency of reducing our global warming emissions and keeping the melting of ice sheets at bay.
And so in order to protect our coastal property, you're saying we have to adhere to the primary goals struck in the 2015 Paris Agreement, capping warming to below 2 degrees Celsius. That requires a rapid transition away from fossil fuels, which isn't happening rapidly enough, Shauna, to get anywhere near these goals. So what is the big challenge there to moving the country and the world in that direction?
There are a lot of cities and municipalities that are doing really great work at this. In Florida, Palm Beach is one example. There are many others. But it's true. We do need to rapidly move away from these coal-fired power plants. There are quite a few in Florida.
That's Shauna Yudvardi with the Union of Concerned Scientists. More on our website later today. We'll be right back.
Without our interrupting your shows, your donations are already flowing in. We don't like to interrupt programs with Pledge Drive, so consider calling WJCT to give now. Individual support is our most reliable source of income. It's what helps pay the $500,000 bill for the shows you rely on every day. Call 353-9528 or give at wjct.org/radiouninterrupted. And thank you.
It's taken years to work out the politics of Brexit, and it's still not done. But the economic realities have already started.
As business owners, they don't know what to do. Things are getting more expensive as well.
I'm Kimberly Adams. We hear about the consequences of Brexit from the people living it. That's next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
The Supreme Court takes up partisan gerrymandering again.
These maps have become so gerrymandered and so warped that the very essence of democracy is at stake.
A closer look at election maps drawn for political gain ahead of 2020. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Janet Napolitano ran the Department of Homeland Security, so she's used to asking questions.
What are we doing to sanction Russia to say, stay out of our democracy?
She says that America is most vulnerable not to having our buildings bombed, but to having our democratic institutions undermined. Next time on 1A. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
This week, Jacksonville hosts the head of Fancaze USA, the leading microfinance organization in Haiti. They provide education, literacy training, and small loans to women in Haiti. Executive Director Maybelle Valdivia speaks here Saturday in Jacksonville at Riverside Presbyterian Church and at the St. Vincent's Spirituality Center. It's a chance to hear all about Fancaze's mission in Haiti. Here's more from Alan Bliss of the Jacksonville Historical Society.
Fancaze makes a difference in a place where so many efforts to make a difference and help have failed. The model that Fancaze follows is distinctive. It uses a combination of education, microfinance, and groups of people who help and support each other. It is, in the classic definition of aid, it's a hand up, not a hand out. The way that people can help is to become aware that Haiti has grave needs, and I think most people understand that, but to become aware that there are ways that people in the U.S. can actually make a difference for Haiti's most impoverished and disadvantaged and excluded and poor on the ground.
So get out to see her this weekend if you can. And finally this hour, it's called The Food of Love. A new take on Cyrano de Bergerac's tale of unrequited love in which two suitors woo their beloved at the same time. And this is a show that takes dinner theater to a new level. Jamario Stills, founder of Phase 8 Theater Company and director of The Food of Love, and Amanda Henninger, chef at Cafe Nola at Mocha Jacksonville, are here now to tell us more about this cool partnership. Hey, guys. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
All right, Jamario, let's start with you. This is dinner theater, but not like what people have known in the past. Tell us about The Food of Love.
Absolutely. This is actually what we would deem as an immersive theater project. In the original, we find Cyrano wooing Roxanne through letters for Christian. In this version, we have Alex wooing Roxy through a four-course meal, which would be prepared by Amanda Henninger and her team at Cafe Nola with our partnership with Mocha. And so in this process, the audience will be taking part in the same dish as the characters in the play.
So when Meg Ryan said, I'll have what she's having, and when Harry met Sally... At this play, the audience is going to get to have
literally
what the actors,
yep,
are having as the play goes on, Amanda. So what is on the menu?
So we've got a couple different things. Started off with just an appetizer of avocado toast. And we've got some prosciutto wrapped asparagus, nice light salad. And then for the entree course, we've got beef burgundy. And then for dessert, it's going to be a blueberry lemon bread pudding.
That sounds pretty good to me. That's quite a menu. So people will have the dinner as the play progresses, but the food is part of the play.
Absolutely. The food is literally baked into the play.
Into the play.
Yes.
So this is an experience that will touch all the senses.
Yeah, we're touching culinary art. We're touching performing arts. And obviously, we're touching the visual arts by being right there in this beautiful museum at the Museum of Contemporary Art. So we definitely urge people to come and see it. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
How did this all come together?
Well, Kelby Siddons, the writer of this project, her and I were talking about what the season will consist of, and we definitely want to merge back into immersive theater. And we began to discuss further how we can highlight the tactile senses of food and taste. And then that led to this amazing project that she wrote. And so Phase 8, we are definitely inspired by doing innovative projects. So this worked perfectly.
And this is happening at Mocha's Theater, which is right where Cafe Nola is located, Amanda. So you don't have to take the food too far.
No, not at all.
Which
it's actually going to be inside. It's going to be in Cafe Nola.
Yeah.
It's not going to be in the theater. It's going to be in the
restaurant.
Yes.
So you'll be seated at your table while how exciting is that?
It's really cool.
Now, this is such a hot ticket that you can only seat 40 people per show.
Only 40 per show. It's a very unique experience, and we want to make sure that everyone who takes part can really dive into it. So $50 are the ticket. You can visit us on phase8.org to order, and act fast.
Get your tickets now for The Food of Love at Cafe Nola in Mocha Jacksonville. two shows, one on April 4th, 7 p.m., one on April 11th, also at 7 p.m., a unique immersive theater and dining experience. Jamario Stills of Phase 8, Amanda Henninger, chef at Cafe Nola. Kudos to you both. This sounds like a lot of fun. So thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening this morning. I'm Melissa Ross. Our producer is Heather Schatz, and our director is Michelle Corum. 1A is up next. And on tomorrow's show, a conversation with Florida author and activist David Lawrence Jr., founder of the Children's Movement. That's tomorrow. Have a great day. And if you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8 p.m., keep listening for the Electro Lounge. See you soon.
WJCT Sustainer is an investor in public media in Northeast Florida. Your monthly ongoing gift of $10 or more is a way to sustain journalistic integrity, quality storytelling, and a local perspective. Become a WJCT Sustainer today. Call 353-9528 or give online at wjct.org/radiouninterrupted. And thank you.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.